In the second edition of The Deming Lens, Dr. Bill Bellows and I discuss incentives and how they affect the organization and the customer. Plus, we discuss the audience question, how can I learn the Deming philosophy? Hi, I'm Trip Babbitt with the Deming Institute podcast. I'm here today with my partner in crime for the Deming Lens, where we look at the world from a Deming viewpoint, Dr. Bill Bellows. Welcome, Bill.
Hey, Trip. Thank you. Welcome.
Yeah, and another thing, I mean, people don't know that you're like a koi pond expert and an In-N-Out burger aficionado and some of those types of things that you do in California.
If you live in Southern California, you have to know about In-N-Out. Our kids just love it. It is a big deal. And their service is remarkable. But and then Koi Pond, it's another fun part of being out here. But Anyway, welcome, glad to get this going.
Yeah, it's an iconic place. Even though I've never had one, and I'm in the heartland of the United States here in Indiana, you know, the land of honey and butter and milk and things of that sort. Let's begin our Deming Lens. We kind of broken it out for this session. We did get a couple questions from some people about how do you get started in learning the Deming philosophy? But I think we'll spend some time talking about some of the things that are going on with the podcast and the blog and the website, and maybe some insights that you have on those types of things. But one of the things I saw just right off the bat was the Deming Institute blog, and this last one you're talking about, I don't know who wrote it, actually, it doesn't say who wrote this one, but it was talking about the Symphony of Profound Knowledge that was written by Ed Baker. And in it, he's talking about Jim McInville, or Mattress Mack, as he's well known. And that was originally in the New Economics, actually on page 39. I looked it up before I called you. And Mattress Mack is doing some great things in Houston.
Well, absolutely. What's funny is, or interesting, most of my personal exposure to Mattress Mack is having seen his name in the New Economics or in Ed Baker's book, as you referenced in the podcast. And he's definitely one of the icons. I mean, for as long as I went to Deming conferences, you'd hear of this Mattress Mack. And I remember even somebody commented that he was absolutely inspired by Dr. Deming, and you can see that in some of the recent interviews done with him, either post Hurricane Harvey. There's some scenes where he references Dr. Deming, and but the other story I have is that people would say, well, the challenge it was to get him to come to a Deming conference. I think it was OQPF and speak, and the challenge was the conferences were during times that were very, very busy, and he was committed to running the company. And so for him to even break away and come tell his story, I know was one for the receiving audience, very well received. But he's definitely an icon in the community, and it's exciting to see his name all over the place for what he's doing. And I've not met him, but I've heard and read many great things about him. He's like just an outstanding individual.
When I first read about him in the New Economics, I was working as a consultant with a radio station. And the story on page 39 in the New Economics is about him getting rid of commissions. Very controversial subject, especially when you're working with radio stations, because the salespeople all have commissions. And the general manager there was reading the book along with me and another gentleman named Tim Bear. We were applying the Deming philosophy to radio stations in this particular case. And the general manager was a woman, and she saw this passage, and she wanted to get rid of commissions at her radio station. And the impetus being what Jim Mattress Mac McInville had done down at Gallery Furniture. That was my exposure, original exposure to him. And it was a challenge. I mean, they were pretty steeped. The radio station was pretty steeped in the Deming philosophy, but the fact that there was at least somebody else doing it that they could read about helped the transition away from commission for their sales folks. There was a bunch of different reasons why they didn't do that, but or why they wanted to get rid of their commissions. But no, he's been doing a bunch of stuff with free pizzas and free turkeys yesterday for Thanksgiving, although this will be released, I guess, a week from today. And he's flown a bunch of people to the World Series, so he's getting quite a name. Really sounds like he's a upstanding guy.
Yeah, and I don't know the background. It'd be interesting to learn more about how he became inspired to attend a Deming seminar in the first place, because when you talk about commissions and radio, and I think of, commissions in big box stores. Yeah, so it's kind of, I find it interesting to walk into a store and get a feeling for the service and the degree to which the people that work there are coordinated. I mean, is your interest their best interest? Is their interest their best interest? It'd be exciting to walk into McInville's stores and get a feeling for the contrast, and you wonder what it's like. It'd be interesting to see the impact that his management style has had in terms of getting rid of commissions and what people are used to thereby, versus going into, I know Sears, and they've had their troubles for some years. I know anytime I walk into Sears, their major appliance section was on commission. But I tell you how it worked out handy, Trip. Because the only time I would go into Sears, I'd be looking for a replacement part for a vacuum cleaner. And I never know where to go to find it. But I know where to go to find help. So when I would walk into Sears, and I'd walk over to the major appliance area, and they would gravitate towards me like I'm going to buy a major appliance. So now I have somebody's attention, right? I got somebody to help me. And I say, are you interested in a major appliance? I says, no, but I need a replacement drive belt for the vacuum cleaner. And so the good thing about commissions in that situation is I know where to find people that can help me. Because short of that, trying to find, with these organizations without a Deming perspective, they cut their expenses by trimming staff, or they have staff that doesn't really know how to help you. So I just find interacting in stores, with organizations, it could be a store, very revealing in terms of their management style. And I don't know if I shared this with you before, but it's about how organizations operate. So we have a big box supermarket kind of thing. And a few months ago, going in there, and I had a carriage, and I'm up to the counter. And for the first time ever, I saw this. What happened there is, before the cashier could complete the sale, the cashier came around the corner to the carriage, and then with his handheld device scanned the barcode that was on the bottom of the carriage. And my first thought was, what a neat idea to make sure that I, as the customer, don't forget that I've got something down there that I want to scan, in which case I got to come back in, or to prevent the store from losing, sales because somebody is maliciously trying to sneak something out the door. So my first thought was, how neat it would be if all the stores adopted that practice, and what it would mean for, better management of the cost of the store. So anyway, went through the whole thing and got out to the car, and I was curious about it. So I went back in and I asked the manager, I said, I'm interested in this and the scanning on the carriage. She said, yes, it's a brand new thing. I said, so is it set up that the purchase can't be completed until the scan is done? Because, you put in a credit card, they want to know the credit card. Is it debit or credit? You put the debit or credit in. And then it'll ask you if you want cash back, and you have to press the button. Then it'll ask you if you want to donate to you know, some charity or something like that. And so it asks you all these questions, and you can't close the sale without answering those. So I thought, well, is it set up that the sale can't be completed without the barcode being read? And she said, no, it's not set up that way. So I was like, how does it work? She says, well, we keep track of which cashiers don't scan, and we talk to them afterwards about that. So we use it to remind them afterwards, and we keep track of those who do it and those who don't. And so I said, so it's punitive. She's like, well, kind of. And I thought, so then, I mean, it's a little bit different than what we were talking about with Mattress Men, but it's just interesting to go into organizations with a Deming perspective and look at how they operate, and look at how they use technology, and is the technology being advanced through a Deming lens, or is it being used absent a Deming lens? And what I'm also reminded there of is Kentaro Toyama, the professor from University of Michigan, who spoke at a conference last year, and his theory and his work experience with introducing technologies in India when he worked for Toyota is that what technologies do is amplify the current way of doing business. They don't change the way of doing business. And when you look at Dr. Deming's work, you say, but of course, because it's going to be introduced, if you use the technology or whatever it is without a Deming lens, it's going to perpetuate that absence of understanding of working as a system. And that's what I saw in that store. So I, on the one hand, I thought, boy, what it could have been. And I pointed out to my son, and he says, well, that's not right. I said, well, this is the contrast between a Deming way and a non-Deming way. Are we working together or are we working apart?
Yeah, technology.
I just wanted to throw that out.
Yeah, yeah, and technology is interesting by itself. I think Acuff probably would have said it's technology does the wrong thing faster.
Yes, that's a very yeah. That's exactly what Russ would say. That's exactly what Russ would say.
Yeah, and then you listen to, and you listen to some of the conversations Dr. Deming would had. You know, he would say, oh, the data is in the computer, gone forever. You know, so he had his read on technology, obviously, calling it gadgets. And you find that so often now, everybody's so technology crazy that they forget about designing something that actually works first, and then realizing that technology is there to enable.
Well, even if you just step back and look at Dr. Deming's ideas as improving how we work together. But I just want to clarify there, what explaining Dr. Deming's work in terms of what we refer to as me and we organizations. And there's a link on our website for people to find out more about our new 8-hour program, Shifting from Me to We, Thinking in Action. And
I listened to that, by the
expression,
way.
Oh, cool. You know, a few months ago, I was doing research, putting the slides together, came across, well, I was thinking of the expression, united we stand, divided we fall. And I thought, well, where's that come from? So I did a Google search. And in my search, and again, what I was led to believe is that that expression, united we stand, divided we fall, comes from one of Aesop's fables, which goes back to Greek times. So this is several thousand years old, that, you know, people were talking about united we stand, divided we fall. So it's, you know, we'd be hard pressed to say that Dr. Deming, you know, created the premise of, you know, working together is a better way to operate. No, that's, people have understood that for some time. But what we're looking at is in Dr. Deming's work, you know, the deadly diseases, which are, you know, things that interfere with working together, or you're looking, I can believe it's chapter two of Out of the Crisis, the obstacles as well as the deadly diseases to working together. And so when you see the world through a lens of collaboration, integration, combination, things coming together, then you say, incentives, are they going to amplify? I mean, are they going to amplify working together, or are they going to amplify working separately? And you're thinking, I think these incentives are going to incentivize individuals to incentivize them to, you know, sell what's best for them, not taking into account what's best for production, or stepping back at what's best for the customer. So when you look at it through a lens of collaboration and integration and teamwork, togetherness, then you say, is this technology, how can we use this technology to amplify that as opposed to amplify the separation?
Yeah, the pieces, as opposed to the interaction of the pieces, if you will. Yeah.
Yeah.
Without a
doubt.
Exactly.
Exactly. You know, Russ talks about the contrast between actions, which are things in isolation, versus interactions. And that's, you know, that's the me versus the we style, a focus on actions and a focus on interactions. And again, and also in volume one of the Deming library with, produced by Claire Crawford Mason and Bob Mason, there's an interview with Dr. Deming and Russ Aikoff. And then there, Russ says, you know, the characteristic way of management we have taught in the Western world is to take a complex system, divide it into parts, and manage each part as well as possible. And if that's done, ... the system will behave well, to which he says, and that's absolutely false.
Hmm.
And then Russ says that. And then, but what's so poignant is their back and forth there ends with Dr. Deming saying, so simple it is, it's so easy it is to understand, yet people really don't know about it. And so what we're finding is that everyone's in favor of teamwork. And the question is, what does that mean? And then you get back to, then you look at Mattress Mac and who's on his team. Society's on his team. You know, the society, the present, society, the future. And that's why it'd be fascinating to learn more about what he's doing. But you get a real sense from all these interviews, this is not window dressing. This is the essence of who he is.
Yeah, no, he's, it's definitely got the attention of the media and, you know, for all those people. What was the book, Bill, where they had the last lecture? And they were talking in the last lecture. The guy that was dying of, I forget what disease he had, but he...
The professor from the Midwest.
Yeah, and you're talking about, he talks in there, one of the chapters, he's talking about Disney, and he's talking about when he went to visit Disney and he had purchased something for his parents, like their anniversary or something. And he'd gone into this Disney store. He'd bought this item and he and his sister were walking out and they dropped it and it broke. And, you know, this would have been probably back in maybe the 60s or 70s. And, you know, they immediately took it back to the store and said, you know, they're broken up about it and said, hey, could you replace this? Because, you know, this, we got this for our parents, and the Disney store did. And they said, basically his message was they had won a customer for life, because here he is as this young kid had gone to Disney World and purchased this item, broke it by accident, took it back, they replaced it, and he said now they got a customer for life. And he basically said, you know, we wouldn't see that today at Disney, you know, that wouldn't be his that wouldn't be the way that we would do it, because everybody's so focused on how much money that they're making and, you know, what they're getting. So I thought there's interesting parallels there that are operating between what is considered to be traditional style of management and what Mattress Mac is out there smashing away at with regards to making life better for people and selling mattresses as a byproduct. That's almost the way that I look at it.
Yeah, well, couple things you just triggered. One is I just did a quick search, and the person you're talking about is Randy Posh.
Randy Posh, that's it. Yep. Uh-huh.
Right, and he was a professor of Carnegie Mellon.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing I reminded in your comment is, and there's a couple aspects of this that just what came to mind is this. You know, the idea of being ethical. And I don't know where, maybe you know where, but I remember hearing or reading Dr. Deming talking about ethics in the following story. And I think the product that he gave in the example is a photocopier. Maybe not. You know, I get to the punchline. He said, so if I'm a salesman for a photocopier company and you're the customer, he said it would be unethical for me to sell you a copier that was bigger than what you wanted. Because then, you know, I'm going to get a really big commission. So I call you up. I said, boy, I got a copy for you. And he said, does all these things. And like, and it's clearly not what you need, but boy, it serves my purpose. So that's unethical. But he said it would also be unethical for me to sell you a copier that was short of what you need. So you need something that does so many, you know, several hundred pages a day. And so I thought, yeah, it's easy to understand it's unethical for to sell a copier bigger than what you need. But the notion that it's unethical for me to sell you a copier which is less than what you need, because I am there knowingly giving you something which is not going to serve you, quote, now and into the future. And the idea that we're looking for the right, you know, what's the right size? And the right size is what works for you has to be paramount as opposed to what works for me. And so that's, and I swear somewhere in Deming's work or in a videotape, maybe I'm making this up. Maybe I heard somebody else say it. But the other explanation, I was in ethics training at one point in my career, and it got to be pretty regular because, you know, the organization got involved in ethics issues and everybody's going to go through ethics training, which, and I enjoyed the opportunity of the reminder. And I know that coworkers valued the reminder because it kept it in the air as opposed to not keeping it in the air, in which case, you know, whether your organization is going to drift to. But at one point in the training, it's, you know, at two different situations. One, it was, you know, ethics, you know, ethical. And during a minute, okay, now in groups, have this conversation. And my, what I brought up to the people was, what's the definition of ethics? I said, obviously, they meant, you know, ethical was don't charge this contract if you're doing the work for, don't charge contract A for work that you're doing for contract B. You know, that'd be unethical. Don't misuse company material for personal use. That'd be inappropriate. I said, okay, I understand those aspects. I said, but if I'm in sales, I said, is it unethical for me to sell the customer far more than what they need? Or is that how you get promoted? And they looked at me like, wow, I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah.
And I just said, well, and they're looking at me like, huh. And the other aspect was, and so the following year, whatever, the other incident or example that just struck me is throughout the ethics training, it was video-based, and everybody in the company is watching it video-based, and you're seeing vignettes. And in the vignette, they interview Trip Babbitt. And Trip is a production line worker somewhere in the company. And then they do takeaways to Trip's fellow workers. And then somewhere in there, and they would do this for not just Trip, they would do this for like four or five people over the 2 or 3 hours. And every vignette would end with the person saying to Trip, why is it that you're so ethical? And then the Trip person would say, well, you have to understand I was raised as an Eagle Scout by my stepfather was an Eagle Scout, or my aunt was a Girl Scout leader, whatever it was. And the resounding message was, I was brought up through my Eagle Scout, through my Girl Scout training, whatever it was, to do the right thing. And so the resounding message, the theme that I heard coming out of this was, do the right thing, do the right thing. And so at one point, I raised my hand when it got to the group conversation. And I said, so what I'm hearing is do the right thing. And people are like, yeah, if we all do the right thing. And I said, by who? Do the right thing by my boss? Do the right thing by my product? Do the right thing by my division? Do the right thing by my company? Or do the right thing by my country?
or by my customer.
All of that. And and look back, I got was, it's kind of like, Bill, you've overthought it. And I thought, no, I said, I think do the right thing is insufficient. We can go back to Acuff. Do the right thing by my action. So on the one hand, I could see where they were going, and they really wanted to simplify it. And I would say, without an understanding of profound knowledge, it'd be really easy to say, okay, everybody, do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And then you and I are on sales commissions, and we know what do the right thing means. It's to get out there, and let's see who's going to win this contest. And just that there was a contradiction, it struck me, but I got these looks like, what's wrong with doing the right thing? And I just thought, that's my Deming. I just can't shake this Deming lens, so to speak. And I'm sure you've been in those situations, right? You've got your Deming lens on it, and you're saying, and the others are looking at you like, Trip, what's wrong with you? And you're like,
well, because it goes against the culture sometimes, because even when you talk to salespeople, they have this misperception of that commission means unlimited money that they can make. And that's never the case. You're always limited by the inventory. You're limited, in the case of the radio station, they were limited by up to a certain point. You could have advertisements, in an hour. But once it got around, higher than 20 minutes in an hour, then you started to lose your fan base because you had too many commercials. There is some constraint associated with commissions. So there's this myth of commissions that I like to call it, where you can just make this unlimited amount of money by virtue of being on a commission. And that helps drive some of this behavior too. Your me versus we comes into play, right?
Well, let me share another story. I don't think I shared this with you, but you just said this prompted me of people and the creativity. So I was working for a company and I was in a engineering finance role. So I was overseeing R&D expenditures and there was an incentive to spend up to a given amount because the R&D was company funded as well as government funded. And the government, every year the company would negotiate with the federal government a maximum amount of R&D, government-funded R&D, and a company would match. And so it was $15 million a year, $20 million a year, $30 million a year. And then the company would negotiate not only the cap, but the company would also negotiate what percent of each dollar was company versus government. So there was an incentive to spend every dollar because if the company spends 50 cents and the government spends 50 cents, then we're going to spend every bit of that. So my job was tracking how we were doing to maximize the amount of that company-funded, government, co-funded R&D. And there was a line in the sand to make sure we were going to, do it up to this point. And all of a sudden, the line in the sand moved from end of the year to sometime in February. And I didn't think of it, but somebody told me, the line had moved. Well, what I found out later was the company changed the fiscal year from 12 months to 14 months. And here's why. The general manager had an incentive for so much in annual profit. And the company was operating 24 hours a day with a number of production lines. So there was no way of bringing future work into this year, right? Here's what companies can do with incentives. We're gonna do the January work in December. But because the company was working 24 hours a day, there was no excess capacity. So in order to achieve the profit goal, the only way of achieving the profit goal was to extend the year.
Yeah. So that's what they did.
And it was several months. That's what they did. And so several months later, an outside firm, one of the big six, big eight accounting companies came in and found out that they had extended the year to 14 months. And the response was that the following year, they were going to make it 10 months. And on the one hand, I could say, well, maybe that really didn't happen. Well, that line in the sand that I was watching literally moved from late November, early December, that line in the sand moved, and that line in the sand was the change in the fiscal year. So when I've got evidence that somebody, told me this, I mean, you can't make this up. I really believe it happened.
Mm.
But it's an example of what the organization will do with incentives to foster what's good for me. What's good for me as the executive, what's good for me in sales, and and maximizing that profit as best they can. And we, that by some would be considered ethical. We're going to go home and sleep at night. But with a Deming lens, you just look at that. Well, with a Deming lens, you could see that coming. Somewhere something's going to break.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, or something will break, or something will happen where it's going to cost them a lot more money than what it did before they thought they were saving money.
Well, the other thing I was going to throw in is for the Deming listeners, those who have heard this expression, it's the question would be, by what method are we going to achieve that profit goal? And there is a method, and in the organization there is a method. But you cannot deny that there was a method to change the year from 12 months to 14. There was a method. You could just challenge, the integrity of that.
One of the situations I got into, too, was I was working with a large HVAC company. I went there and they had an interesting system of how they distributed their technicians to a home or business, and most of it I think was residential. They had a three-tier system. So if you were in the top tier, you were considered one of the best technicians because you were bringing in the money. If you were a tier two technician, you were okay, but you weren't that top tier. And then the third tier was either technicians that were on their way out, they were weeding them out, or they were new, and they would get warranty work for air conditioning and heating units. My Deming lens basically told me, I wonder why they're doing this. Well, I was invited to one of their morning sessions. They had a bunch of folks there. Their pictures would go up on the wall, and they'd get clap, and because they had sold the most that month. And everything. And so pretty soon, as I started to ask better questions, I learned that the tier one technicians were getting basically any residential home that had heating and air conditioning units that were over 10 years old. So basically what they would do is they would go in and they would not try to fix it. They'd just go look at it and then they'd say, you need a new one. And by virtue of the homeowner buying a new one, it kept them at the top in the tier one. The tier two folks is where I found all the people who actually knew how to fix things. They would go into a home and they'd say, "Oh, well, yeah, you can just replace this part here, and your unit will that didn't put them into the top tier." And you could see it. I mean, when we did visits to homes, you would even see where a tier one technician had gone in at one point and a tier two at another point, and the tier one would just say, "You need a new one," and the tier two would fix something. And it was an interesting dynamic that was at work, but you could tell that customers were kind of getting they were understanding what was happening in the system. So I always warn people nowadays. I say whenever you go someplace, and one of these, especially when it's something when you don't know about what they're doing, like heating and air conditioning units and car repair and things of that sort, it's always helpful to know whether the people that you're working with have some type of incentive or bonus or commission associated with what they're doing, because the people that were getting serviced, if they got a tier one, you weren't getting your unit fixed. It was you're being told it's just old. You got to replace it. That's my final story. We ought to switch over to this question from a couple of people about how do you get started in the Deming philosophy. What would you say to them?
as somebody becomes excited, you know, as a result of a short conversation or sitting next to somebody on an airplane for several hours and like, so what do I do next? And you say, well, one is improve your understanding. So that could be any of a number of things. I mean, so for our website, it could be looking at our podcasts, looking at our blogs, the videos, and we're not the only ones with content. So there, it could be looking at Russ Acuff's work or Alfie Cohn's work. But it's, so one aspect is, you know, given this short exposure, how could someone deepen their understanding? Two is, how might they be able to apply that, you know, these ideas and get a sense for how they work? And that's just no more than, you know, becoming more aware of the environment you're in and taking some of the examples we've been talking about and just saying, you know, instead of being incentivized by what's best for you, what if you step back and looked at the person that comes into the clothing store and instead of saying, boy, I could sell you a tie, I could sell you, say, so Tripp, tell me where you're going. You're buying this tie and where are you going? I say, oh, I'm going to a wedding. I said, oh, do you realize we have these other options? So it's becoming aware of the people downstream that you interact with, which is, you know, the guise of how might these ideas be applied. And then another aspect I think is vital is improving your ability to explain it to others.
Mm.
And because you can do some things on your own, but some things require others. And so as you develop the ability to apply it and understand it, the other thing you ought to be thinking about is that what is your capacity to explain these ideas to another person? And there what we do is encourage people to start with one person, a brother, a sister, a mother, a father, and find a coworker, and then find someone you could explain these to, and together you can do some amazing things, because in the long run, your ability to apply the ideas is going to somehow involve having a supplier know what you're talking about, a coworker know what you're talking about, a boss understand what you're talking about. So it's kind of simultaneously, how can I improve my understanding? How, starting from where I am, how can I apply what I currently know? And what is my capacity? Because, you know, and the people that I've been mentoring, you know, they're very, very excited. But what I keep reminding them is, you can't be the only person that knows this. You've got to rely on others, because there's so many things you're going to need to be able to do. Rely on others. And you want them to help you and you to help them. So, and then, you know, what we're trying to do on our website to enrich society through the Deming philosophy is provide access to your blogs and videos and podcasts that can enable what I just mentioned, as well as, you know, seminars and conferences and workshops. So that's what comes to mind.
Okay. Yeah, I guess mine was... When somebody asked me that question, a lot of people will send folks off to read Out of the Crisis, which I think is not a good place to start. It's more a conglomeration of notes as opposed to anything where you're going to get what you need to get out of something at the beginning. And The New Economics, though, I think is a good place to start. And I think following that up with maybe participating or at least listening to the New Economic Study sessions, I think would be a good place to kind of digest some of these things. But you're right, there's a bunch of videos that are made available through the Institute that you can watch and listen to. Some people are interested in the history. The one thing that I do know, and we both know, and we've talked about this quite a bit, is that individual learning is just that. It's individual and it's subjective. So it's subjective to how you learn. And so there's multiple ways that you can begin to start to understand the Deming philosophy. If you enjoy videos, go that route. If you like reading, then go that route. But there's a lot of different ways now. Or attend a seminar that's put on by the Institute. Your MeWe one, and you know, there's also the 2.5 day if that's the way that you best learn. But then I think you start to take that, what you're seeing, and I think you apply your own Deming lens to things. You take a look at it, your own organization, say, wonder why we do that. And I think then this gets back to, again, some of the conversations that you and I've had, Bill, about becoming aware of how you think. What is your current thinking, and what sits with you and what does not? And for those that are struggling with some of the things that are in there, that they can talk it through with someone, whether they get someone to mentor them or, you know, look for answers of what they're doing. But inevitably, one of the things that I find are sometimes people reject too early, because they sit there, they'll say, oh, I saw they're against commissions, therefore they're all communists or socialists or something, and or performance appraisals. There's always something in the philosophy that may counter what your existing thinking is. So I would encourage people to struggle with those things, and also consider this question, which is, have you ever tried it a different way? Well, which is some of the things that I ask, you know, my clients, in essence, is, have you ever tried to operate something without the commissions or without performance appraisals? What might happen? You know, what are you afraid of? So, yeah, now I think the Institute is definitely putting out a bunch of material for you to be able to get knowledge. But again, my recommendation is always, you know, start with the new economics. It's a relatively easy read, if you want to call any part of the Deming philosophy easy to comprehend. But I think it builds a good foundation for folks where they can kind of begin to understand what's contained in the philosophy.
The other thing I was thinking about when you were talking that really hit home is the value of a mentor. And I know, you know, when I started 30 some years ago studying quality, I had the great fortune of somehow coming across some people that I reached out to. This is, you know, the day of landlines, long before cell phones, long before, you know, the internet. And I remember contact them, and you find out that there are people that are willing to engage you, and you find out, you know, not everyone has the time, but I think if you're really serious about becoming more steeped in the Deming system of management, then one, as you pointed out, you can participate in new economic study sessions led by Tim Higgins, and people will ask, well, what do I get out of reading it as a group? And as you pointed out, as you find out that others have either similar or different interpretations of what Dr. Deming's talking about. So you get a chance to balance your impression versus others and find out where they're similar, where they're different. And so you're not learning. Well, what does that mean? It means you're learning together. I had the great fortune of being mentored by Shinichi Taguchi, by Russ Acuff, by Tripsy Ranney, by a number of people that work closely with Dr. Deming. And I'd like to think that the people who write our guest bloggers, our podcast interviewees that you work with, and people in our videos that speak at our conferences and whatnot, people that are listeners, if they're looking for a mentor or potential mentor, could reach out to, and or it could be somebody you work with. But I think don't underestimate the value of a mentor. And the other thing that comes to mind is our daughter was asking for help some months ago, and I pointed her in the direction of people that she's met through me. And I said, you know, reach out to them. And they were women. I thought she would, given the question she was asking, I thought a woman's perspective would be valuable. And I said, they will fall over backwards to help you. One, now they may give you different advice coming from where, you know, they come from different places. But I told her, I said, Allison, we don't get through life on our own. And so this is why when you mentioned mentor, to really dig into Deming's work, you really need a mentor. But you could say the same thing of becoming really good at stained glass. So I would say is if you haven't figured out the value of a mentor, boy, I don't know where, I mean, I just can't imagine where I'd be without mentors. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, you go to college and right? Did you take a class where they talked about trip, make sure you find the mentor?
No.
I mean, somehow we figured that out.
Yeah.
But it's not, it's, and as I turned to our daughter, I said, holy cow, be serious about a mentor.
Yeah, I think that that's...
Or mentors.
Yeah.
Mentors.
Well, and I think, too, two people, you know, obviously it would help to have somebody that's skilled, that's worked with it for a while, because there's certainly plenty of pitfalls, especially using the Deming philosophy, and you can certainly go down a wrong path really quickly without some skilled help at some point. But even if you're, you know, getting started and you're struggling with some these ideas, then, you know, just having a friend that's, you know, maybe at the same pace you are, helping each other, and then just know that you have the Deming Institute too, where you can reach out to it and either find answers through, you know, some of the plethora of videos or podcasts or blogs out there. There may be an answer out there for you already that helps you think through a particular sticking point.
Well, there's one other thing that comes to mind based on that is for those folks who are, who are wrestling with that question you just brought up is of, you know, how do I learn? How do I apply? What we also encourage people to do is keep a Deming journal. And in that journal, have their questions that are in need of a mentor or just, you know.
Yeah, that makes
but
sense.
But just keep these things in a folder that you've got a place to go back to. And I know, you know, whenever I went to see Russ Aikoff or Dr. Taguchi or others, I had a ready place to go and a question would come up, and I'd say, next time I see them, I'm going to ask that question. And so the value of having a journal, a personal journal, and I've got a number of people I'm mentoring, and it's cool. I kid them, I put that in a journal and said, oh yeah, it's like, you know, journal two or journal three already. And so, you know, this becomes a, you know, very serious personal learning journey.
Yes, no, I agree. I think, and what, you know, on a couple of these, well, the question when it came up of, you know, how do you get started with Deming philosophy, an accompanying question to that these folks put into it was, I'm not in a position to actually change anything at my company, you know, and as opposed to maybe getting to that now, because we've discussed quite a bit at this point, but that can certainly be fodder for the next Deming lens, which is, okay, I understand a little bit about the philosophy. We're not doing any of that. And I'm just a middle manager, or I'm just a worker, or I'm just one of the executives, and nobody else that I'm sitting with is going to, you know, listen to any of this. You know, how do I address that moving forward? And you know, I think the saying of, you know, the monarchy is not looking for change. So, you know, that's the kind of the attitude that you need to take into it. We can discuss that the next time. We'll conclude this episode of The Deming Lens. And we hope you enjoyed our conversation about quite an array of things, actually, from commissions to incentives to things of that sort. So we hope you enjoyed the show. Want to give to the Deming Institute and are not sure how? Go to deming.org, select Give, and then select Ways to Give. Please send me your feedback and suggestions to trip@deming.org, or go to our Twitter account @DemingPodcast.